Coming up on this week's book show, National Book Award-winning and best-selling author Colin McCann's latest, A Paragon, is an epic novel rooted in the unlikely real-life friendship between two fathers who recognize the loss that connects them and their attempt to use their grief as a weapon for peace. Colin McCann on this week's book show. Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. National Book Award-winning and best-selling author Colin McCann's latest, A Paragon, is an epic novel rooted in the unlikely real-life friendship between two fathers. Bassam Araman is Palestinian, Rami Elhanan is Israeli. They inhabit a world of conflict that colors every aspect of their daily lives. From the roads they are allowed to drive on, to the schools their daughters each attend, to the checkpoints, both physical and emotional, they must negotiate. Their world shift irreparably after 10-year-old Abir is killed by a rubber bullet and 13-year-old Smadar becomes the victim of suicide bombers. When Bassam and Rami learn of each other's stories, they recognize the loss that connects them and they attempt to use their grief as weapons for peace. Colin McCann's previous novels include Transatlantic, Let the Great World Spin, and Song Dogs. Again, his new novel is A Paragon. It is a great pleasure and an honor to welcome Colin McCann to this week's book show. Thank you very much for being with us.
I'm so happy to be with you. Thank you so much.
It should be noted that the characters of Bassam and Rami, of course, are not just characters, they are real people. What was it like the first time you walked into a room and met them?
It blew my heart wide open. I was in a town called Beit Jala, which is right near Jerusalem, right near Bethlehem. It's a Palestinian Christian town. And I walked into this office where these two seemingly ordinary men were sitting, and I knew that they were about to tell me a story. I was with a group of musicians and artists and activists, and when they began to tell me their story about how they had lost their daughters separately in separate incidents and had banded together to work for peace, I was completely taken. In fact, it's one of those moments, you know, those moments where your world gets cleaved open and you know it's happening the moment it's happening. And that's what occurred with me. And I came back to New York where I live, and I couldn't shake them from my mind. And I think as writers, we work towards our obsessions. So I thought, okay, this will be my next novel. And sure enough, I spent the next 4 years working with Rami and Bassam and their beautiful voices.
You have made note of this, and I find it interesting, especially in reading the novel, but you were confused by the situation in Israel and Palestine, as so many of us are. And how does that impact the writing of a novel of this and that still is confusing?
Exactly. And I think that speaks to our times. Look, I come from Ireland. I was, I've studied the Northern Irish peace process in and out. I grew up with them, with bombs going off in my mother's hometowns. And I will say this, that Ireland still confuses me. And I think it's good to acknowledge our confusion. I think it's good to acknowledge those precious little words, I don't know. Because I think we're diseased with certainty nowadays, and so diseased with certainty that we won't let anybody else into our wheelhouse whatsoever. It's like, you know, I'm going to sit in my room, I'm going to close the curtains, I'm going to lock everything down. I'm right and you're wrong. Whereas the truth of it all is, in most scenarios, whether you're talking about Republican and Democrat, Israeli, Palestinian, you know, Catholic, Protestant, is that this stuff is really messy, and we have to acknowledge the jagged, sort of dappled edges of it. And when we do so, we actually get a privileged insight into the idea that the human being at the core of all this matters. It's not the facts. It's not the figures. It's not the disputed histories. It's not any of these sort of things. What really matters is the living, breathing, beating heart that's there in front of you. And so when I went into to write about Israel and Palestine, I sort of acknowledged that. And I try to even do it at the start of the novel, which is bounces around a lot, and it deliberately sort of knocks the reader off balance for a little while until they get used to the rhythm that's there. It's actually written in 1001 cantos, and you know, it goes from through history, through the music, the history of explosives, and so on, but always returning back to these two central characters, these two men, and the story of their daughters.
Talk a little bit about that structure of the novel. As you mentioned, 1001 chapters, and there is a count up and then a count down, and it's as if these ideas just explode across the pages. Going back to what you just said, if you were less interested in the facts and the figures and more interested in the heart, how were you able to figure out really that texture and tell it in that way?
Well, there's a lot there. One of the things that I have to say is that you know, like writers, we work like musicians, and you go into the studio and you try this out and you say tambourine here and guitar there and violin there, and you build up the sound and build up the sound until you know it happens to be right. With me as a writer, it's often the same way, and I'm not nearly as intelligent as my readers happen to be. My readers put the intelligence on a book afterwards. So when I was starting this book, I thought, okay, it's going to be fragmented. Fine, fair enough. Maybe I'll write it in 50 different sections. And then I thought, ooh, maybe I'll write it in 100 different sections, and that would be hard. And then I was thinking about it a lot. And Rami and Bassam tell the stories of their daughters. And it struck me one day that they were keeping their daughters alive by telling their stories. And there was a sort of Scheherazade notion going on there. Scheherazade being the hero of 1001 Nights or Arabian Nights. And then it hit me. And this is almost 2 years into the whole process that it hit me. You know what? I might have to do it in 1001 different sections. And that was oh, you know those moments you get when it sort of hits you with the force of an axe, and you think, right, yeah. Well, this is what I've got to do. And it turned out to be the structure that was best for this particular book, and that's why I call it a paragon. And a paragon is a shape with a countably infinite number of sides. It's kind of a crazy title, but I like it.
So, talk about how that title fits what you wanted and the way that it, because it does so beautifully fit what is presented to us. When did you latch on to that word and that concept?
Guess what? like before I even wrote the book. So I was writing a book called Transatlantic, which was largely about the Irish peace process. And right. I was looking for a word to describe the sort of multi-sided facets of it. Because it's not just about two sides. And so, of course, I found polygon and decagon and hectagon and all these different things. And then in an obscure corner of the internet, I found this wonderful word, a paragon. And I didn't use it in Transatlantic, but I remember tucking it into my sort of, you know, my back pocket, if you will, thinking I might use that in days to come. When I told my publishers, they gave me a very polite cough. Just like, okay. And then I told them it's about Israel and Palestine. They gave a second very polite cough. But I have to say, they were very brave. And they allowed me to go ahead and to, you know, get into this territory, which is, I mean, frankly, it was frightening. I mean, I'm Irish. I live in New York. And here I am about to embark on a novel that takes place primarily in Israel and Palestine with a Jewish man and a Muslim man who become best of friends. That's a lot of territory to cover.
Colm McCann is our guest in this week's book show. The novel is A Paragon. It is published by Random House. Obviously, when you take on this situation, there's going to be a certain amount of concern / controversy, especially with a quote-unquote outsider looking at it. What do you think you bring to that story, and how much did that concern you, if at all?
It did concern me, but you know, I talked to Rami and Bassam, and I said to them, "Look, I want to write a book about you." And they trusted me from the get go. And I said, "But no, you have to understand. I want to write a novel about you, and I'm going to make things up." And they and again, they said, "That's okay." And then it struck me that you know, all I had to do was to get at the beating heart of what it was that they wanted to say, is which is that we need to know each other. They're not talking necessarily about one state, two states, eight states, federation, confederation, you know, whatever it happens to be. They say in the beginning, we need to know one another. And if we don't know one another above ground, we will end up knowing each other 6 feet below ground. And I knew that if I could get to the force of that message, everything else would fall in place. But I went over numerous times. I rode on Rami's motorbike. I drove in Bassam's car. I walked through checkpoints with them. I walked in the hills. I had dinner with their families. And I got to know them. And in certain ways, they told me things that they had never told members of their family. And it became an extraordinary process, but it is a novel after all. And I still am sort of inventing things in certain ways. And, you know, and it's in the invention, I think, comes the truth, or in the invention, I hope, comes the truth.
In looking at that truth, when you present it the way you do in these cantos, that say 122, the rubber bullet knocked Abir face forward to the ground. That's it. But that gives it so much more power, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, it's very much about rhythm. It was very much about music, about contrapuntal music and shifting and moving. There's even two sections that are left blank. It has to do with a weird mathematical idea of amicable numbers or friendly numbers. And constantly I wanted to, as I say, sort of disrupt the reader, throw her off balance a minute to say, why is that happening? Why is that sentence so short? And why is this sentence so long? And why is there a photograph here? Because I think it builds up a portrait. The other thing about this book is, and I haven't really talked about this really anywhere, is that one of the things that happened to me was that I realized that halfway through, again, I didn't know who the narrator of the book was. Now, that's going to sound weird to your listeners. How can a writer not know who the narrator of a book is and already be 2 years into it? But I didn't. And I thought, well, is it me? Or is it some sort of, you know, omnipotent character looking down? Neither seemed all that interesting to me. And then it hit me that the narrator was not only me, but the reader too. And maybe that happens with every single book. Maybe that's true of every single book, that the reader is the actual narrator. But with this book, I actually explicitly say it in section 1001. It's like you and me, we're sitting in this monastery, listening to the stories of these men, and you make the story as much as I do. In other words, you're complicit in it and you're involved. And I kind of love that because I also love and admire and learn from my readers sort of constantly.
I love that idea of being complicit because we are navigating it and understanding it and then telling the story again to ourselves, really.
People get different things from the book, but I think that this is a friendship between two extraordinary men who should not be friends. Mm. They should be enemies, but they've decided not to be. Is the glue that holds all of this together. And so while the book challenges you to think about lots of different things, it says, on a simple level, we need to get to know each other. And whether that be in Boston and Kentucky, or Belfast and Lima, Peru, whatever else it happens to be, or even just across the street between red and blue, between people of different political persuasions, we actually need in this day and age to be acknowledge the nuance and the multitudinousness of our experience. I'm a big fan of Whitman and that line. Do I contradict myself? Very well, then I contradict myself. I am large. I contain multitudes. And I love, America is such a multitudinous country. And I think increasingly we're getting away from the multitudinous elements and we need to get back to them.
How do you think we do that? There is such a tunnel vision that has developed. I mean, just going back to that idea of the paragon of, looking at all of the sides instead of just the one that you are focused on.
I think it has something to do with a certain amount of humility that we have to learn to go in somewhere with our heads bowed, saying, again, I don't know, or, but I want to know you. I have weird ideas about you, but I want to change them. Now, I'm the co-founder of a group called Narrative 4, and we do a lot of work actually in the Northeast. And what Narrative 4 does is it brings young people together to tell each other's stories. And one of the projects that we did was we brought kids from the South Bronx, the second poorest congressional district in the United States, mostly African-American, mostly or immigrant, together with kids from Kentucky, Eastern Kentucky, Floyd County, mostly white and Cherokee Indian, together in a room to tell one another's stories. At first, they were terrified of one another. But when they got into the nuances of each other's story, the beautiful little flicking things that you don't recognize, like the girl from the South Bronx, she's wearing a hijab, but underneath her hijab, she has AirPods and she's listening to, rap music. And suddenly she becomes, she's so much more than I thought she was. She just looked to me like a person in a hijab and I automatically had stereotypes about her. Once I get to know her story, then, the world becomes a wonderfully messy, complex place. And I think it's in that complexity that we're going to get back to ourselves. I think, certain people have talked about this down through the years, but I'm figuring that our young people know this pretty well and they can recognize that, we're pretty complex human beings, but we are human beings. And that's one of the other things that Rami and Bassam do. They say, we immediately recognize the humanity in one another. We did not want each other to be the same, to think the same. He's Israeli, I'm Palestinian. But we recognize the absolute humanity in one another. And that's very important.
There is just in that story some complexity in the sense that when those two men will appear together, there will be groups protesting outside. And that just doesn't compute with me. Right. You try to figure out how when you have people who are trying to forge a relationship and peace that in some way can cause a controversy.
Yeah, I mean, it is amazing. You go to a school in Israel and there will be basically groups out there, almost riots at times, trying to stop Bassam from coming in, because people think that he conforms to their idea of a terrorist and he's Palestinian and that their kids will get corrupted and all these sort of things, when really Bassam waits and bows his head and always gets in, and his idea and Rami's idea too. Is that if they can get to the heart of one kid at the back of the audience, they have done their work. If they can stop the drop of one little ounce of blood, they will have done what they intended to do. Change their minds, put a crack in the wall. Because if you put a crack in the wall, eventually, and we all know this, whether it's Berlin Wall or the walls in Northern Ireland or the walls in our own hearts, eventually they all have to fall. That sounds kind of romantic, but I also think it's a really tough and muscular thing to say too, because it's easy to be cynical. It's not easy to be an optimist.
Colin McCann is our guest on this week's book show. The name of the new novel is A Paragon. It is published by Random House. Birds play such a part, a theme, if you will, in the book. I'm curious as to how that came about, and is it something you actually noticed on your trips to Israel and Palestine? Were the yes. birds?
Yeah, I noticed the birds, but really, what happened was this. You know, this is the miracle of Google. When I met Rami and Bassam and came back home, I had written down that I'd met them in the town of Beit Jala. I Googled Beit Jala. And in Googling Beit Jala, I noticed that it had one of two bird ringing centers in Palestine. And I said to myself, what's bird ringing? It turned out to be bird banding, which I didn't know anything about either. But I thought it was really beautiful, where you capture a bird in a net and then you put a little tag on it and sort of identify it. And then I realized, oh my word, this Israel and Palestine is on the path of one of the greatest highways of migratory birds in the world. So birds were coming from Ireland, from Sweden, from South Africa, from Algeria, from Israel and Palestine themselves, and coming to this place. Just like I believe that we as readers have to come to the story of Rami and Bassam, and in that sense, we, the readers, are sort of migratory birds. And the other thing is, I didn't really know anything about ornithology, but I learned a lot in the process. These birds are so beautiful. This is the incredible thing. There are a billion birds every year fly over this area of Israel and Palestine. And I just thought, I've got to use that image, because it's so... The birds are free, and yet they're not as well, because they still have to land and they still have to be tagged. That was a fun thing to learn.
Am I making this up, or I thought your name, looking at the Irish, is a dove.
That's correct, except it's either a dove or a pigeon.
Man, it doesn't matter, does it?
I think I'm more of a pigeon than a dove, to be honest. But that's very good. Yeah, it's Colum, like Colum Kill, Colum Bawn. They say in Spanish the paloma, bird of peace. But I think I'm a scrappier than the bird of peace. In fact, I have a little story in the book where Philippe Petit, the tightrope walker, walks across Jerusalem and releases a pigeon halfway across on the wire, and the pigeon lands on his head.
I'm lucky enough to have a friendship with Philippe. He has appeared in another one of your books, of course. It's amazing. He is a fascinating figure to go Incredible. Back to, isn't he?
Oh, I just think of him, what he does with knots, what he does with the idea of creativity, what he does on a tightrope, what he does on a unicycle, what he does in his head. He's a poet, and I think he's been one, 9/11. We're yes. thinking about 9/11. When I go downtown to look at the buildings downtown, I don't see the towers that are there now. I still see Philippe Petit up in the air, from 1974, walking across these two towers as an act of art, as an act of imagination, that is, so sort of brazen and beautiful that it, even though it only took place once, it exists forever. And that's the great thing about art and the great thing about Philippe Petit.
Did you know that he did that in Jerusalem?
It was only like sort of halfway through the book. I think, didn't Philippe do some sort of walk of peace? And wasn't there something to do with a bird? And this was how my mind was working when I was writing the book. You know, one thing would meet the next, And I began to see how intricately it was all connected and the fabric of our world. We live in some sort of fantastic mosaic.
You know, it's fascinating to me what you choose as subjects. There is such an emotional complexity and beauty to this novel that I can't imagine coming out of it.
You're so right. I mean, probably more than any other novel I've done, and I've written 10 books, I'm not able to get out of this one, and I'm not sure I'm going to be able to get out of this one for the rest of my life. It just means so much to me. It was a culmination of so much about storytelling, about peacemaking, about engagement, about our global status. All of these things are sort of twined together. And while I have tried since finishing it to step out into a new novel, I actually even tried a failed COVID novel, I've not been able to break it just yet, which means I don't know. I'm waiting for the inspiration. If you have any ideas, I'd love to get some.
It's a hard thing to top, right? I mean, even by the subject matter of something that is all consuming.
One of the extraordinary things that's happened with the book is that there's been a lot of movement, in philanthropic circles, in relation to, you know, looking after a group called the Parents Circle, which is where Rami and Bassam, these families who are bereaved, they get together and they work together. Money that's come from the United States, money that's come from England, from people who have read the book. And also there's an Abir Smadar Foundation, which is about to be set up. And Narrative 4 is part of, has been receiving a lot of attention because of these two men. But the one thing that I hope happens in all of this, I truly believe that Rami and Bassam should be invited to Sweden at some stage. And I think you know what I'm saying, for the Nobel Peace Prize.
Right.
Because alongside, say, John Hume, you know, George Mitchell, you know, Arundhati Roy, Murray Corrigan, all these incredible people, I think, you know, Gandhi even, and MLK, I think Rami and Bassam stand up there in the fact that they're so unusual and so brave, and they take so much, they get so much thrown at them, so much criticism thrown at them, which is, as you said earlier, is kind of startling. Why in the world would these people of peace get criticized? Well, because peace is complicated, and there's a lot at stake, including money, territory, ideas, and people who are invested in not keeping the peace. And so that's why I think if they could get a huge award like that, it would be amazing.
Yes, quite lovely. The name of the new novel is A Paragon. It is published by Random House. Colin McCann, I thank you very much for being with us. It's a great pleasure to have you on the program and to have you share with us.
It's my great pleasure. Really, seriously, thank you so much. I really, really appreciate you and your questions, and best regard. Thank you so much.
Be well. Thank you so much. Colin McCann's new novel is A Paragon. It is published by Random House. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.